no involvement in the case, but had been following it in the papers, nudged their chairs out of line, bit by bit, with impatient shifting. She wanted to know if Alfred was there, but she kept her eyes fixed on the neat seams of Mr. O'Neill's suit jacket. There was a momentary hush when those closest to the door spotted her, and a collective creak as several dozen spectators turned to see her for themselves. Some were on her side, Mary hoped, as she crossed the room and kept her focus above the heads of the witnesses. She'd seen the editorials in the paper, the people who believed she'd committed no crime and should be set free to live and work in society like everyone else. Then there were the papers that refused to use her real name even after it had become public knowledge. The Germ Woman, their headlines still read. Readers had written in to ask if breathing near Mary Mallon put a person at risk. What about touching what she touched? What about entering a room shortly after she'd left? She hoped the sympathetic were in attendance at the hearing, but all she felt as she made her way to the front of the room was the scrutiny of 50 people looking at her so closely in the muggy air that she felt handled, groped, every bit as dirty as she was accused of being. Mr. O'Neill placed his briefcase on a scratched and dented wood table at the front of the room. The men from the Department of Health were already seated at a similar table across the aisle, and Mary made the mistake of looking at them, one by one, until her glance jumped to the row behind them, where Dr. Soper's dark head was bent over his notes. A man in a blue uniform stepped forward and announced the arrival of Judges Erlinger and Geigerig. Mary hadn't expected two judges, but she was relieved to see that she'd be able to keep them apart in her thoughts. Erlinger was a big man, and Geigerich was no larger than a girl. "All stand," the court officer called out, and the clap of chairs being pushed back was thunderous. Mary looked toward the three large windows on the western side of the room and noted that the day had darkened. The metallic smell of rain had seeped indoors. When the people returned to their seats, there was stirred up in the room the odor of vegetables, of horse, of blood. Judge Erlinger pressed a handkerchief to his forehead and then briefly to his nose. Mr. O'Neill cleared his throat. He began the way they'd discussed, with an account of her arrest in March of 1907. "Without a warrant," he said, "without due process, the liberty of a perfectly healthy individual..." Mary could see that he was nervous. He was 5 years younger than she, only 34, but he never seemed as young to her as he did when he touched his fingertips to the edge of the battered table and stood. "Mary Mallon has been quarantined for 27 months with no one to keep her company but a gardener who delivers her meals 3 times a day. She has submitted to testing, urine, blood, and stool twice a week for that entire period. The nurses who collect her samples are certainly no company, and she dreads their visits because of the anguish they cause. Her friends are not permitted to visit, despite the fact that every doctor associated with her case admits she is contagious only through cooking." Mr. O'Neill continued, sticking only to what was relevant, and as he spoke, Mary found her thoughts drifting. For 27 months, she'd craved the streets of Manhattan, the chaos, the noise, haggling over the price of an orange, debating the accuracy of the butcher's scale. She missed her work, rising before the rest of the house, removing the first shining pot from its hook, lighting the fire under it, dropping in a spoon of butter and watching it skid across the warmed bottom. She missed earning money, walking to Dicer's on First Avenue, picking out a basket full of groceries, paying for it with clean, new bills. She missed Alfred, most of all, and every morning when she woke, she wondered whether he was also awake. She often caught herself thinking of him the same way she once thought of the people from home when she first got to America, all the way across the ocean, 21 days at sea. And then, when she remembered that the East River was not the ocean, was not even as broad as the mighty Hudson, everything felt more urgent, and these were the moments that made her wild, as the doctors called it. Combative, difficult, stubborn. Obstinate, ignorant, female. There were about 5 million souls rushing through their days over there. She could see their chimneys and hear the sharp whistle of trains. Somewhere over there walked Alfred, and unlike those she missed from Ireland who were so far away that she'd quickly drawn a curtain across the possibility of ever seeing them again, the idea of being so close to him and not seeing him made everything worse. If she had more courage, she might have tried swimming across like the young men from the House of Refuge on Rikers tried from time to time. But then she reminded herself that most times, if the papers told the truth, those men turned back, often stopping at North Brother for a rest before doing so. Or drowned. John Kane once told her that the East River was the fastest, roughest river he ever knew, especially around North Brother. At the time, she'd been on the island only a month and thought he'd been rubbing it in, reminding her that there were no options for her. But after watching those same waters for 27 months, she knew he'd just been stating the truth. 10 o'clock in the morning was not Alfred's best hour. She thought of his long, white legs, splayed out on the starker white of their bedsheets. She thought of him standing by the window in his shorts. She thought of all the eggshells and orange peels that had probably collected in the sink for 27 months, all the bottles that would need scouring. She thought of him in work clothes, making his way up the building's stairs to their flat on the 6th floor. Who talked to him in the course of a day? Where did he take his meals? She thought of him running his hand along the curve of her back to her backside and pulling her toward him. She missed seeing human beings other than herself and John Kane, who had a strange fascination with watching her eat what he brought for her from the hospital kitchen. The night before the hearing, when he should have been worrying about getting her that iron in time, he'd brought her 2 slices of beef threaded with gristle, a limp salad, a roll. "The people cooking for this hospital should be lined up before a wall and shot," she said as she inspected the meat. John was the tiniest little sparrow's fart of a man, but he laughed with the strength of someone full size. She'd been asking John to bring her flour, yeast, butter, a few vanilla beans, nothing to make a proper meal but ingredients for bread, something she could work with in the mornings when it was too early to step outside. But he just held up his hands and ignored her. She wondered what they'd told him about her. Why asking for simple ingredients always prompted him to say goodbye and hurry across the green space like he was being chased. Mary observed 2 flies float in through the window and then out again. The clop of horses, a large team from the sound of it, passed on the street outside, and Mr. O'Neill paused for a moment. Mary heard the door at the back of the courtroom open. She heard a man's low voice asking pardon as he tripped across knees to an empty seat. She heard the voice again, louder, and the sound of it was like a wire pulled up her spine. She felt the small hairs at the back of her neck. The stirring she heard behind her seemed to be moving closer. She felt bodies shifting. Chairs creaked. People exhaled the hot breath of annoyance. "Sir," Judge Geigerich said, looking at the source of the disruption while holding a hand up to Mr. O'Neill, "is this entirely necessary? There are 2 seats on the aisle right in front of you." "I want to sit near Mary," the man said, and Mary turned to find herself no more than 3 feet from Alfred, who was dressed in a gray sack suit with a jacket over his arm and wearing polished shoes. Borrowed, Mary thought. The shirt, too. She hoped he'd give it all back in the same condition. "Hello, Mary," Alfred said. He looked healthy, fuller in the face than he'd been when she last saw him. Eating, she hoped, sleeping at night. Mary drew a breath, wanting to speak to him, but felt everyone in the room looking at her, the reporters poised with their pencils to paper, the others with their arms folded or their eyebrows raised. She turned back in her seat and faced the judges. Mr. O'Neill concluded his point. "Mary," Alfred whispered. He'd gotten the seat behind her. Mr. O'Neill cast a sidelong glance at her, a warning not to turn around. "You look nice." Mr. O'Neill turned abruptly and gave Alfred a stern look as one of the lawyers for the Department of Health launched into all of the various reasons Mary Mallon must remain in quarantine. Mary dropped her hand to her side and made a little wave beside the seat of her chair. He would see it if he knew to look for it. The flies flew in through the window again and this time circled the room. 2 more followed. A child's voice below the window called out the names of the newspapers he was selling. There was the sound of someone running. A cart being pushed down the hall on the other side of the courtroom doors. "How are you?" she whispered over her shoulder. Beside her, Mr. O'Neill dropped his pencil and pushed his pad of paper away. "Oh, I don't know," Alfred whispered back. "You look well?" "I'm better, Mary, much better than before." "Good, that's good." They stared at each other. Mary twisted in her seat. Alfred leaned forward on his elbows. She felt hot, reckless, and wondered what would happen if she got up out of her seat and walked out of the courtroom on Alfred's arm. She noticed that he didn't look nearly as uncomfortable as everyone else in the room. His hand was cool when he reached out and covered hers. "Will there be a break?" he asked, no longer bothering to whisper. "Mary, please," Mr. O'Neill said. Across the aisle, Dr. Soper coughed, and when Mary looked over at him, he was looking right back at her, as if daring her to do exactly what she was tempted to do. His hair was combed back off his face, and he was one of the few men in the gallery still wearing his suit jacket. "I don't know," Mary said to Alfred. "I really don't know." "Well, then I'll see you after, won't I?" Judge Erlinger interrupted the man from the Department of Health. "Miss Mallon, do you need to excuse yourself?" Mr. O'Neill gave her a look that meant it was her last warning. "If you leave this room," the look said, "this is the last you'll see of me." Mary felt Alfred's hope float up behind her, wrap itself around her shoulders, and pull her toward the door. They would send guards with her, she knew. Without looking at the judges or at Soper, Mary turned and faced the front of the room. "No, sir," Mary said. "He's an old friend." A titter went up in the gallery, and Mary put her hand to her left eye. "Go on," the judge said to the lawyer who'd been speaking. On the other side of the room, in the very back row, a reporter for the Examiner noted that the germ woman seemed upset. Was she crying? Was she scratching her face like a cat? He leaned forward in his seat, tried to get a better angle. Crying would go over. Crying made sense. He watched her bring her fingertips to her eye and then back to the table and felt his body flinch. He opened his notebook. Germ woman, tearful through proceedings, careless with bodily fluids, even in court of law. 7. Once the hearing date was set, Mr. O'Neill came to North Brother once more. They went over their strategy, and he told Mary that he wanted her to swear before the judges that she'd never cook for hire again. "It's your best chance," he said. They believed she was sick, that she was passing typhoid fever from her hands to the food she served. That she'd never been sick a day in her life was of no relevance. "How can it be of no relevance?" Mary asked. The last ferry going back to the city was due to depart shortly, and she wanted to be clear with Mr. O'Neill on her position before she said goodbye. "How can I spread an illness that I've never had myself?" "I only mean that it's of no relevance to them, but it's entirely relevant to our argument. It's a new theory of disease, Mary," Mr. O'Neill explained. "Dr. Soper..."
"Don't talk to me about Soper," Mary warned him. "What kind of a doctor is he, anyway? I've been asking for 2 years and no one has explained it properly."
"He's a sanitary engineer. He..."
"A what?"
"A part of his job is to track diseases to their source. The garbage, for instance. He's done a lot of work for the Department of Sanitation, and he's been a consultant for the IRT since it opened. Remember when everyone was worried about breathing microscopic steel shavings? They called him. He was already making a name for himself, but finding you has made his reputation."
"And that's why I'm here, isn't it? So he can make his name."
"Mary," Mr. O'Neill sighed, "things could be worse for you. You have a private cottage. You have the freedom to move about the island."
"An island the size of a park, where everyone I meet shrinks away from me?"
"It could be worse."
"Well, yes, Mr. O'Neill, you're absolutely correct. I could be dead, I suppose."
Of the many witnesses called the morning of the hearing, a few surprised Mary. Most were people who worked for the Department of Health, or who worked at labs scattered across the city, and who canceled out one another with their opposing views of her case. Half thought that since Mary was a healthy person and had never shown any symptom of the disease she was accused of passing on to so many, the city had no right to imprison her. Others felt just as strongly that it was precisely because Mary showed no symptoms that she must be kept in quarantine for life. "Think of the innocent," urged a doctor named Stamp, whom Mary had never seen before. "No one will think to avoid her in the streets. No one will hesitate from inviting her into his home. Seeing her good health and her experience, what would stop her from being hired to cook in a good house? The Bowen child was only 9 years old when she died of typhoid fever." Mary had hoped that Elizabeth Bowen's death was one more thing Dr. Soper had made up, wanting to make her situation worse. It had seemed too convenient to their cause.
But Mr. O'Neill confirmed it was true, and Mary supposed he had no reason to lie. And now there was an unfamiliar doctor on the stand confirming that truth. Mary remembered the quiet girl who read books and listened to her governess and preferred her bedroom and the parlor to the fresh air outside. Sometimes she came downstairs to see what Mary was making in the kitchen, and a few times Mary had let her dip her finger in a sauce or take a stewed apple out of a pot with a spoon. One time, Elizabeth asked Mary why she wasn't married, and when Mary told her it was because she didn't feel like it, Elizabeth said she'd marry Mary in an instant if she'd been a boy. Then she said, "Is it really because you don't feel like it, or is it because you haven't anyone to marry?" "Aren't you bold?" Mary said. "How would you like to pick up someone else's socks all day long?" Elizabeth made a face. "Isn't it better to earn wages?" "Yes," Elizabeth said, entirely convinced. "And don't forget," Mary told her, "if I were a married woman, I probably wouldn't be here making your supper." The first sign that Elizabeth was sick came when she wandered into the kitchen and announced that she was tired. Mary had looked carefully at the girl and thought of Tobias Kirkenbauer. On the day Mary was taken, the girl had been upstairs, sleeping, her governess watching over her. She'd had the fever, yes, Mary remembered that well. She wanted to tell them the best way to help her, the best times to put her in the tub, the coolest cottons to wear next to her skin. She'd sent up a bowl of beef broth to give the girl energy, but they didn't want to listen to her and sent the broth back down with Frank. She wanted to see the girl for herself, but once the family called the doctor, they closed the girl's door to all of the staff except for the governess. And when the governess became ill, they had the doctor tend to her as well. One of the reporters had gotten Bet to talk, and Bet told him that Mr. and Mrs. Bowen loved throwing dinner parties more than anything else in the world, and now they were afraid that no one would ever want to come to their home again. According to Bet, Mrs. Bowen vowed that every domestic she hired from now on would be a Swede or a German, because they were more impeccable than every other race. When the reporter asked what Bet thought of Mrs. Bowen's opinions of Germans and Swedes, Bet agreed that it was probably true. She was fired within an hour of the paper landing on Mr. Bowen's desk. Since the Bowens didn't want to talk, didn't want to even admit in court that they'd welcomed such a woman into their home, that they'd eaten her filthy food and become sick because of it, Dr. Soper interviewed their friends and neighbors instead. And once one of the reporters caught wind that Soper had been talking to the Bowens' neighbors, so did that reporter. It was printed in the Evening Sun that the germ woman had too many ideas about herself, and because Mrs. Bowen didn't tolerate her attitude, the germ woman infected her on purpose. The stories claimed that Mary was resistant to some of the ways of good Christian households and purposely defied them by meeting strange men on corners. Mr. O'Neill made a point of addressing the main rumors that were printed in the 1907 papers, because those would be the details the judges would recall. "How can I be resistant to Christianity when I'm a Catholic?" Mary demanded of Mr. O'Neill. "Tell me that, please. And the man I met once on the corner was a stranger only to them, not to me." Mary shared with Mr. O'Neill the observations she'd made ages ago, that all the great houses of New York City are the same. They're headed by women who should have been male and should have been ministers. Women who go down to the employment agency in their white gloves to look around like they're in a brothel, discussing terms with the madam while each whore to be hired looks on. Then, when the terms are agreed upon, instead of directing the cook to the kitchen or the laundress to the laundry, every lady gives a speech about joining a Christian home. The first thing they ask is whether I'm church going. You'd think it would be something to do with cooking, but no. They want to know whether I get myself to a church on Sundays. "Do you think the right answer is yes?" Mary asked Mr. O'Neill, who listened and waited without showing any indication of what he thought. "Well, it isn't. Experience taught me that the better answer is no. This gives the lady a chance to instruct a new hire on the beneficence of our Lord. They all say they want a good cook, but what they want even more is a worthy project." "What has this to do with anything?" Mr. O'Neill asked. "We were talking about rumors we'll need to address one by one when we're in front of the judges. What does it..." "It has everything to do with everything we've been talking about. Don't you see? They..." "Yes?" Mary thought to tell him again about the hat, but remembered she'd long since given up on making that point. "Look, if you don't see, you don't see. I wasn't a project for them. I refused to be. I was there to cook as well as I could, and I was damn good at it. But at 37, I was past the project stage. She went along with it in previous employments, but that time, with Mrs. Bowen, a mood took her. The first time Mrs. Bowen brought up Our Lord, Mary laughed and said he hadn't made it downtown in years. "Oh, Mary," Mrs. Bowen had said. There was also the imbroglio about the food cooperatives just a few days after confronting Mrs. Bowen with the twin to her own hat. Mrs. Bowen found Mary in the kitchen to tell her that she and a few of the other ladies had decided to organize their cooks into groups on a trial basis. Together, the cooks would learn the new French methods and more exotic cuisines that she and the other ladies would decide on. "The idea is to be together," Mrs. Bowen said, "and learn from one another. And it would be a help to you, wouldn't it, having other cooks to work alongside instead of just being here by yourself?" Mary went to the church hall on 64th Street to meet the other cooks and saw that there were only two others. They had the whole place to themselves, and their conversation echoed in the vastness of the empty, wood-paneled room. It bounced off the many droplets of glass hanging from the chandelier. The back room of this hall featured a state-of-the-art kitchen that sat empty most nights of the week, except for Saturdays, when the church held socials for its parishioners. The kitchen had ceramic double-pot sinks, a zinc-lined icebox, plenty of workspace. The three cooks were charged with making a meal for six families. It was to be like that, just on Mondays and Tuesdays, for a start. One of the cooks, Claire, seemed to know more than the other two, and informed Mary that when they finished up, Mary was supposed to deliver a meal to the Compton family on 61st Street, on her way back to the Bowens. They were to follow Claire's direction because she had more training in the French method than the other two. "So I'm now the cook for the Bowens and the Comptons?" "I don't think we're meant to see it that way," said Ida, the third cook. "I think we're to see it as the three of us cooking enough of a meal to do for six families. Not you have these two, or you your two, and so on, you see?"
"And where are the cooks for the other families?"
Mary didn't see. She usually considered herself the brightest in any group, but the Bowen girl had been feeling poorly, and she was distracted by it. Again and again she tried to get up to the girl's room, and again she was barred. No one had yet mentioned the word typhoid. "The other cooks were scaled back," said Claire, "told they are needed only Wednesday on." "So," Mary said, like she was waking up from a dream, "we cook here as a group and deliver the food to all these families. That way six families get fed for the price of three cooks instead of six cooks." The three looked at one another. "For the purpose of saving money?" Mary said. It didn't seem like the right answer, but there couldn't be any other.
"There's something like this happening on the west side," Ida said. "I have a friend. Her employer calls it a cook's cooperative. It's cheaper for them, and she says that the idea is that after a while we won't work for one particular family anymore. We'll be asked to leave our rooms, then we'll have to get rooms elsewhere and commute to the place we are to cook, just like any other day cook or common laborer."
"We won't do this," Mary said to the other cooks. And that night, for the first and last time in her life, Mary intentionally ruined good food and talked the other two into doing the same. They overcooked the tenderloins. They boiled the asparagus until it was stringy mush. They withheld salt from the potatoes and put it on the cobblers instead.
"I hope it turned out well," Mary said to Mr. and Mrs. Bowen when she served them later. "I'm not used to having to transport my dishes. It's best, you see, straight from the oven to the table."
"Could you not choose a dish, Mary, that would support being transported?" Mr. Bowen asked as he probed the meat with the tine of his fork.
"Of course," Mary said, bowing her head. "We could limit ourselves to just a few dishes that we know would work."
"Limit?" Mrs. Bowen asked and pushed her plate away. Once Elizabeth got sick and they realized it was typhoid fever, there was no more mention of cooking in the church hall, or of cooking at all, for that matter. Mary made bread and a thin soup that would keep, and spent most of her hours hauling ice up the stairs and the empty bucket back down, the only helpful thing they would allow her to do. They kept the block in the kitchen sink, and Mary put Frank to work, charging at it with a butcher knife until it came to pieces, little ones to suck, larger ones to serve as flows in the tubs upstairs where the family bathed, and the single tub downstairs where the servants took turns. There was an ice shortage in 1907, and ice was very dear, but Mary ordered blocks on credit and hoped they wouldn't ask for a settlement of their books before the girl recovered. In their first interview, Mr. O'Neill asked Mary why death didn't bother her, why she didn't notice it following her everywhere she went. Mary didn't even know where to look for a starting point. After so many months on North Brother, so many years since setting foot in Dobbs Ferry, Mary could still feel the silk of Tobias Kirkenbauer's curls when he passed under her hand, and the way he settled himself on her hip, his arm slung around her neck as if he had no fear in the world as long as she was holding him. How could anyone think she didn't notice, or that it didn't bother her? No one in any court of law, no man in any room, knows the desperation of squinting through dim light and seeing a baby's cheeks inflamed, feeling the hot hands, the eyes gone flat with fever. A twist came in Mary's belly that was the beginning of a prayer. Back in 1899, when little Tobias Kirkenbauer wouldn't open his mouth to eat, who pressed the creamy water from the boiled oats and spooned it into his mouth? I did, Mary reminded herself. And he held on longer than he ever would have if Mary hadn't been there. But they didn't know about 1899. To them, 1899 was not on the record books. And if it was really true that Elizabeth Bowen died, then of course that bothered her. Of course. The girl was only a child and deserved no badness. 8. When Mary was a child, her grandmother told her that as long as she kept the piss pot clean and her apron white, there would be no mistress who would turn up her nose at her. It was over her grandmother's turf fire that Mary learned how to make griddle cakes and brown bread, where she first browned bacon and boiled beef, made salmon with butter and cream, eel and trout. It was her grandmother who taught her the best way to tuck the turnips and potatoes around the meat. And it was her grandmother who saved enough money to buy Mary a one-way passage to America when Mary was 14. There would be food in America that Mary had never seen, but the rules were the same. Cook it right. Draw out what's good. Don't be afraid of putting things together. Her grandmother's sister, Kate Brown, would give Mary a place to live, help her find work in New York. Send her, Kate's letter back to Mary's grandmother had read. I'd love to have her. Mary's first impression of America, when she arrived in Castle Garden in 1883, was that it wasn't a kind place. Soon, after she had steadied herself, her bag secure in her hand, she was hustled into one grim line after another, like one mangy cow in a herd. Other ships had also arrived that day, and she waited and watched as the kaleidoscope of colors kept shifting. Green aprons, yellow headscarves, red tassels brushing the ground, dotted ribbon pulled through belt loops to hold up short pants. The American men were the ones with the broad faces and derby hats pulled low. She imagined a welcoming party, but instead, one ugly man shoved a card in her face, and another, even uglier, braced Mary's head with his large hand and told her to hold still while he used a button hook to lift her left eyelid and then her right. "Trachoma," he said. "Highly contagious." Mary didn't understand the first word, and barely heard the others, locked as she was in a posture of fear. When he finished and announced her eyes clean, she noticed that the man wiped the hook on a towel draped over the railing before moving on to his next victim. Patty Brown, Aunt Kate's husband, met Mary when she'd completed all the lines and gotten all her stamps. "Mary Mallon," he said, when she approached the only man left in the waiting area that fit his description. "Follow me." She followed him down a flight of stairs to the sunshine outside. They passed through the gates of what seemed like fortress walls, and then she was on the outside, on the streets of New York City. They climbed aboard a trolley, drawn by a pair of glum-looking horses. When they came to the end of the track, they got out and made their way on foot. Mary struggled to keep up with the old man, who, with his hunched shoulders and his badger's head, kept disappearing into the crowd. "Where is this?" she asked, hoping conversation would slow his pace. "Where are we now?" He raised a calloused finger and pointed roughly at a street sign that read, 37th Street. Finally, as the crowds thinned and she followed him onto 10th Avenue, Patty Brown loosened his stride. "Wait here a minute," he said, just before ducking into a store with a tuft of wheat carved on the sign outside. "How much farther?" Mary asked. "Just 2 doors down." Mary dropped her bag to the sidewalk and tried to get a feel for what waited for her, but 2 doors down looked the same as every door they'd passed for the last several blocks, dark and plain.
Rusted staircases stuck to the faces of every building, and from their railings hung a variety of sheets and blankets. Where home had been full of greens and blues in summer, oranges and reds in winter, New York was the same color wherever she looked. The muddy avenues, the muck-splattered carriages, the gray shingles, the faded red brick, the coal smoke that hung in the air and blurred the outlines of everything. The buildings were tall, 5-6 stories. When Patty came out of the shop with a loaf of bread, she pointed at the bedding hanging above their heads and asked him why. "Too heavy for the lines," he said. "I see," she said, though she didn't see. She looked forward to Aunt Kate and tried to comprehend that somewhere inside one of these buildings that showed their shame to the world lived her Nana's sister. She searched herself for the tug of home. "How was the journey, anyhow?" Patty asked then, looking at her for the first time since meeting her. The girl in the berth below Mary's had died when they were 10 days at sea. In 21 days, Mary watched 7 bodies slide into the sea, all wrapped in sailcloth and sewn tight. The girl was dropped on the same day as another person, a man by the size of him, and when she fell through the air between the deck and the water, her body bent at the hips. Mary wondered if they'd double-checked, if they were absolutely beyond a doubt sure. Someone in the crowd remarked that it was only the grace of God that would keep the rest of them out of the water, and someone else said amen, and Mary wondered why God would grant any of them that grace and not those who'd already been thrown away. It wasn't the first time Mary noticed that God had a haphazard approach to things. "Was it very rough?" Patty asked. "No, it was grand," Mary said, and looked back at the garbage lining the street, the haggard people rushing about on the sidewalks. Mary's aunt had more welcome for her, and scolded her husband thoroughly for not carrying Mary's bag. She'd prepared a rich lamb stew, with carrots and potatoes that went cold before them, because every time Mary went to put a spoonful in her mouth, Aunt Kate asked another question about a person from home. Patty and Aunt Kate had no children and were too old to remedy that fact. "Well, now," Aunt Kate said when Mary had finished giving her the news and they'd taken 5 minutes to eat what was on their plates. "First thing is to find you good work, then we'll see. What can you do?" "I can cook," Mary told her. "Cook what? Spuds? A bit of ham? What else can you do?"
"I want to cook."
"Mary, love, they have stoves in America you've never seen the likes of."
"I can practice on yours."
"This?" Aunt Kate laughed. "This is nothing. This is a stone's throw from the turf and the open fire. There are kitchens in some of these houses that have stoves wider than..." Aunt Kate stretched her arms as wide as she could to either side. "They have stoves with 4 burners, 2 ovens.
I can learn, can't I?"
"That's true, I suppose." Kate regarded Mary with a smile. "Patience, love. It's very good to see you." After giving Mary a few weeks to settle in, to get accustomed to the pace of the streets and the chaos of the pedestrians, the horses, the freight train that plowed along 11th Avenue and didn't stop for anything, after showing her the spider's web of clotheslines hidden behind the tenements and the tub for washing, after letting Mary get used to her cot next to the kitchen table and showing her how to put coal in the stove and empty the ashes, after taking Mary to meet yet another neighbor who wanted to know her business, and after learning that no one understood her when she spoke except for other Irish, and teaching her how to enunciate, speak slowly, try to talk more like an American, Kate finally announced it was time to go to the agency and see what kind of job Mary could get for herself. Mary had just turned 15. Kate told her everything she should say and made her practice at the table after Patty had gone to bed. She had Mary sit across from her with her hands folded, and then she asked questions about the jobs she'd had in New Jersey and Connecticut. Mary was to describe how she was an accomplished cook and had cooked for families in Ireland before leaving. "You are 20 years old. Same birthday, just subtract 5 years from the year."
"But what if they ask where? What if they ask me to describe New Jersey or Connecticut?"
"They won't. But if they do, you go ahead and describe whatever you imagine.
Be confident. They've probably never been there themselves."
Mary tried to speak slowly and sound older than she was, but the woman at the agency just told her in a blank tone that they'd place her as a laundress.
"Are you a worker?" the woman had asked.
"A real worker?"
"I'm a worker," Mary assured her.
Report with clean clothes, spotless, and keep your person clean at all times. Be respectful to the family and their guests, and for God's sake, don't try to engage them if they don't engage you. If one of the families enters a room that you are in, simply exit as quickly as possible. You have no opinion of politics whatsoever, and in fact, do not follow politics of any kind. You don't read the newspapers. Do you understand, Miss Mallon? Yes. The agent handed her a folded pamphlet that repeated everything she'd just said. Are you religious, by the way? Catholic, I imagine. Catholic? The family has probably already assumed you're Catholic, or will when they meet you, but don't mention it yourself. Mary didn't know what it meant to be a laundress, and hoped she could prove herself, and one day be allowed to cook. But she discovered in that first situation that cook and laundress are two different tracks, and a laundress never becomes a cook any more than a cook becomes a lady. At home, they'd washed their clothes in the river and draped them on rocks to dry. Aunt Kate washed her clothes in a basin, twisted them roughly when she pulled them out, and hung them on the clothesline that stretched across the tops of the outdoor privies to the back wall of another tenement. The night before Mary began, Aunt Kate showed her the little square ounce of Reckitt's Blue she kept in the pantry and explained to her about using it for the final rinse to take out any hint of yellow. Fine clothes needed more careful treatment, and she warned Mary that if she encountered anything with a lace collar or cloth-covered buttons, to go over them with the sponge instead of sinking them in the tub with the rest. The family was called Cameron, and Mary slept on a bunk in a room off the kitchen. She took her meals with the other staff. Room and board would be deducted from her wage. The woman at the agency had gone over the deductions so quickly that Mary didn't have time to calculate until she got back to Aunt Kate's, and together they realized there would be hardly anything left over. "But it's good experience," Aunt Kate said. "There's value in that as well." Patty Brown made a low sound and shifted in front of the stove. As the woman at the office predicted, the footman, Nathaniel, who'd been charged with greeting Mary and giving her a tour of the home, told her that she would be required to join in the evening prayers nightly. The mistress did not take her faith lightly and required her staff to approach Our Lord with the same seriousness. "What if someone refuses?" Nathaniel studied her face. "Try it," he suggested. The Camerons had help that cooked, help that cleaned the house, did the laundry, watched the children, taught the children, tended to the grass and pots of flowers outside. When Mary had a free moment, she was supposed to help Martha, who was forever running an oiled cloth over the furniture, up and down the stairs, beginning every day where she'd ended the last, and doing everything over again so that no speck of dust ever had a chance to land. The expression she wore on her face was one of combat. She was engaged in a battle that offered no respite, and even while eating lunch at the small kitchen table with the rest of the staff, she was squinting over their heads, peering into corners, and tilting her chin to see in a different light what lurked there. It was the cleanest place Mary had ever been. The newspapers Mr. Cameron left open on the table in the sitting room talked of poor ventilation and crowding in the cities, toxic odors that came from standing water and horse manure. But the Cameron home was so protected from anything like that, so unlike Aunt Kate's or the rooms of any of the families Mary had visited on Aunt Kate's block, where there was no place to keep the garbage, except piled on the curb, outside, where it would stink until the Department of Street Cleaning came by with their carts, where every person who walked through the door of their building tracked the mud or ash or excrement from the street up the stairs, through the halls, into their own rooms, that Mary started to feel that she was also waging a war. They all were. And Mary's particular front was at the collars of shirts and blouses, the hems of skirts and trousers. According to the papers, the source of every disease suffered by every New Yorker could be found in a garbage pile on the Lower East Side. Mary heard the word miasma, and the next time she went home, she asked Aunt Kate what it meant. Ever since then, she imagined the city streets seeded with invisible landmines, and the landmines were these toxic clouds, miasmas that floated up from every dirty thing left to fester at the city's curbs. She tried not to inhale when she made her way to and from the streetcar, or on the many occasions when the sanitation wagon skipped Aunt Kate's block. She felt safer at the Camerons, where all day long, 6 days a week, she and the others led a coordinated campaign against dirt and disorder, and where the sanitation drivers never clicked their tongues at their horses to speed them past the door.
Every member of the staff had one day's leave per week to go home, and perhaps they weren't as careful when they were back on their own territory. One Monday morning, the Cameron's longtime cook returned to work with the telltale bull's neck, but pretended nothing was wrong. She just slammed pots and pans and began the ritual of the water, with her chin tilted toward heaven, gasping for air. Mary and the others hid her as well as they could, but Mrs. Cameron liked to come down to the kitchen once in a while to discuss the evening meal, and she chose that Monday to tell the cook, in person, that the family was bored of beef roasts, and chops, too, for that matter. Could the cook come up with a trout or a flounder on a Monday? "Oh," Mrs. Cameron said when she saw the cook's neck and retreated to the hall. She put a hand up to her own throat. "You're ill." The cook couldn't speak, so her assistant, the girl who rinsed and chopped vegetables like they were criminals and her knife a weapon, spoke for her. "She's just after telling me they have standing water in the air shaft where she lives, and on Saturday when we parted, she expected the water to be stinking. This morning she told me, yes, it was fierce stinking, and no one in her building can keep a window to the air shaft open with the smell of it. It'll go on until a dry stretch, so she thinks she breathed up that odor in spite of the closed windows." Just that morning, on her way from 10th Avenue, Mary had to hold her breath as the trolley rolled by a horse stable, where, on Sunday nights, the men who cleaned the stalls pushed out all the horse shit and old hay. Next to the stable was Vice's bakery, and before dawn on Monday mornings, the Vices splashed out all the old milk that hadn't sold the week before. They threw it over the shit pushed out by the neighboring stable. As the sun rose, the milk soured and infected the air. Often they tossed old eggs, too, and the carcasses of chickens, and crates, boxes, papers, packaging, overflowing ash cans. The eggs bothered Mary most of all, and every time she passed on a Monday, she wondered why they didn't put them in a cake, or give them to someone who needed them. The waste of it made her never want to buy anything there. "Why can't she speak for herself?"
"Oh, she can,"
the assistant said meekly, but the cook sat down on a stool and put her head in her hands. "You're dismissed," Mrs. Cameron said, taking another step backward. "Please, go home and tend to yourself. Be in touch with the agency when you're better." The cook showed no signs of moving as the assistant fetched her shawl and wrapped it around her shoulders. "You have money?" the girl asked, then looked around. "Could we pitch in for a fare?" Along with Mary, there were two others of the house staff present. Mary slid her hand into her apron pocket and closed her fist around the dime and five pennies resting there. Mr. Cameron always left a tip when she starched his shirts, and it was a game to find it. Sometimes he left it in one of his shoes, twisted into a hanky and tied off with a string. Sometimes in the pocket of one of his shirts. Sometimes he came upon Mary while she was working, sneaked up behind, and dropped it into her apron pocket. Mary would jump at the sudden tug of the money, and he'd be there behind her, smiling. It was something, Mary understood, she wasn't to tell the others. Everyone put coins on the counter. Mary's quick finger separated out three pennies, and she added hers to the lot. "Well," the assistant said when she came back. Mary could tell she'd already elevated herself to head cook. "I'll need to go to the fish market. One of you will need to start..." "Pardon me," Nathaniel said, breathless from running down the stairs. "Missus says that you're to go too, and that if any of the rest of you feel ill, you should do the right thing and excuse yourself."
"Me?" the assistant asked. "But I feel fine."
Nathaniel shrugged.
"And the rest of us are to take 15 minutes to scrub the kitchen again."
After the scouring, Mr. Cameron appeared in the kitchen and asked who could cook a meal until the office sent over another woman.
"I can,"
Mary said, taking a silent survey of the fruit and vegetables on the counter, the cheese and milk she'd seen in the icebox. Mr. Cameron ignored her. Martha could not change positions and was off limits. "Jane?" he asked the children's tutor, but she said she'd never cooked a thing in her life.
"I can cook,"
Mary said again. Mr. Cameron frowned. "Mary, then." And so Mary took off her laundering whites and put on the cook's apron instead. After that first meal, baked whitefish with leeks and tomatoes and a vanilla cake for dessert, Mr. Cameron teased that they would cancel their request to the agency for a replacement cook and instead ask for a replacement laundress. He took on the habit of having his morning coffee in the kitchen before heading out to work, and then,
After one morning when Mrs. Cameron came looking for him and demanded to know what exactly he thought he was doing, he stopped, and Mary was left alone. A week later, the new cook arrived, and Mary was sent back to the pile of muslins and linens that had been waiting for her. "I'll leave this position," she decided. "I'll go to a new agency and tell them a history as cook, and they'll believe me. And if they don't believe me, I'll go to another agency." She took out her small brush, her square of starch. She rubbed the dry patches on her hands. 9. There were times, over on North Brother, with John Kane staring at the way she spread jam over a piece of toast and bit off the corner, when Mary felt like none of it was real. Even 2 years on, the doctors still spoke to her like she was a child, and she tried to find new ways of reminding them that she'd served food to people who once dined with the President of the United States of America. And, after tasting what she'd prepared, they'd looked up from their plates to study her more closely, knowing she was not entirely what she seemed. Beneath the plain attire and the cook's hands, behind the thick Irish accent and the working-class posture of exhaustion, they saw something else, a level of taste, an understanding of what those seated at the table were really after, a challenge to the palate, a meal to be enjoyed and not just consumed. Mary wanted Mr. O'Neill to know that there were some doctors who had an unhealthy obsession with her bathroom habits, far beyond the scope of the case. "They'd watch me go if I let them," she told him. 2 years earlier, she wouldn't even have been able to say that much, wouldn't have even been able to make a glancing reference to going. They could make all the insinuations and comments they wanted about Alfred and the rooms they shared, why they weren't married, what kind of woman this made her. None of it bothered her as much as the discussion of her bathroom habits. Shortly before Mary met Mr. O'Neill, one of the nurses who came to collect her samples joked that she envied Mary. "You've got your cottage on the water, free rein of the island, no balance to be paid to the grocer, no child hanging off of you, no husband to face at night, no younger brothers to put through school. There's more than a few who'd trade with you." The nurse said this as Mary placed on the floor the usual glass canister that contained her sample, mixed in a solution that looked like water. The nurse handed her a second canister for her urine. Mary usually tried to shroud the contents of the canisters with paper or a napkin, wrapping them separately at first and then together, like a package that needed a bow. And doing so allowed her to pretend for a moment that what was happening was not really happening. But that day, because of the nurse's comment, Mary shoved the jars in the other woman's direction without wrapping them, pushed them into her hand so roughly that the nurse fumbled, almost dropped them. The contents sloshed inside. "Careful, miss," the woman said. "I'd say the same to you," Mary answered. The doctors admitted that more than a third of the time, Mary's samples came back showing no typhoid bacilli whatsoever, and her urine came back negative 100% of the time. When Mr. O'Neill asked about past pressure they'd put on Mary to submit to a gallbladder surgery, they conceded that they no longer believed her gallbladder was to blame. Her intestines, perhaps. Her stomach. They weren't sure.
"Good thing you were stubborn about surgery," Mr. O'Neill said to Mary later. "It would have been for nothing."
Mary had occasionally wondered why no one had mentioned her gallbladder in a long time, and now she wanted to go up to the hospital and demand an apology. They were animals. They would have risked her life for sport.
"Let it go," Mr. O'Neill said. "We'll address all of it at the right time."
He said that it was essential that they humanize her at the hearing.
"Make me into a human?"
Mary asked, confused.
"Well, yes. What I mean is, we have to paint your story so that anyone, no matter what their station, will sympathize. And, better yet, make them afraid that they could end up like you."
"So in acting for me, they're really acting for themselves?"
"Exactly. So, what were your feelings when you were told you were being brought to North Brother? Were you aware of the tuberculosis hospital here?"
"My feelings?"
"Were you afraid? Did you even know of North Brother? Where exactly it was, for example?"
"Of course," Mary said, looking at him steadily. "Of course I knew where it was. Doesn't every person in this city know?"
Mr. O'Neill seemed about to say something but changed his mind. "You think I don't follow a newspaper, Mr. O'Neill? Even the illiterate in this city know exactly where North Brother is? There's more to getting news than reading it in the paper. There's talking, too, isn't there? Or did you assume
We don't talk about the same topics you talk about. Wasn't the General Slocum disaster only 5 years ago? She did not admit to Mr. O'Neill that she'd never heard of North Brother before June 1904, when the General Slocum burned. But forever after, she thought of those people whenever an errand brought her near Kleine Deutschland, Little Germany, where most of the people on the General Slocum that day were from. More than 1,000 people had burned to death or drowned, and Mary thought of that number when she looked out over the East River now. Men, women, children, all bobbing in the rough water, pushed back and forth and under. A story went around in the weeks after the tragedy that the manufacturer of the life preservers had slipped in iron bars to make the weight minimums, that the captain and crew had abandoned the ship and its passengers and taken a tug from North Brother back to Manhattan, refusing to look at those in the water who cried out for their help. Inmates from the House of Refuge on Rikers swam into the water to help people and then swam back to their prison that night. Mary often went down to the spot where survivors had stumbled ashore, sometimes imagining that she'd been on board, that she'd been one of the women who jumped into the river and made it to North Brother. And when she wasn't looking, occupied perhaps by the sound of her own breathing, distracted by her gratitude for her life, her back turned, her ears closed, she'd been left behind and forgotten. The hearing would not be a quick one. That much was clear within an hour. As the sun rose higher and heated the odors of the room, Mary felt weaker. She watched sweat run down the sides of Mr. O'Neill's face. Judge Erlinger's eyes had begun to close. One doctor, instead of answering anything specific about her case, lectured exclusively on the bleeding of horses and how it was no longer necessary to bleed a horse to death in order to obtain the maximum amount of serum to make vaccines. Take diphtheria, for example, he went on. There have been several cases where the horse's reaction is so strong that death came too quickly, and the glass cannula used to collect the blood were broken in the horse's fall and destroyed. A murmur went up among the other doctors. Mary leaned over and asked Mr. O'Neill why they were talking about horses. "The best thing," the man went on, "is to always bleed from the carotid vein and not the jugular. The jugular will weaken the horse too quickly, and in most cases result in less blood collected. But even more important, the use of supports must," he banged his fist on the chair for emphasis, "become standard practice across the labs. A large male horse can be suspended with two stout ropes, one passing behind the forelegs and one in front of the hind legs. Once the support is in place, the cannula should be inserted into the artery. By this method, it's possible to obtain 5 usable gallons from a single horse." "And where do you stand on the Mallon case?" the DOH lawyer urged the doctor. "In terms of typhoid, I think the answer lies in widespread milk pasteurization. Cleaner water. Better education on personal hygiene. Typhoid is entirely preventable." "So, should she be let back into society or not?" The doctor faltered, looking over at Mary. "It's my opinion that she should not." One Department of Health official asked the judges to consider what exactly motivated Mary to take the job uptown at the Bowen residence in the first place. Did she harbor a resentment of some sort against the upper classes? Did she resent the Bowens in particular? Perhaps because of the food cooperative Mrs. Bowen had attempted to organize? Without waiting for answers, the official then sat back as if he'd just put the final piece in the puzzle. "I worked for the Bowens because of what they paid me," Mary whispered urgently to Mr. O'Neill, who bellowed an objection. "It was illogical," Mr. O'Neill pointed out. "A woman can't be accused of lacking the ability to comprehend her affliction at one moment, and then accused of wielding it like a weapon the next." "And why did her employment with the Warrens end in Oyster Bay? Why did she not continue to work for them once they returned to the city?" "Because it was a temporary job," Mary whispered to Mr. O'Neill, but he shushed her. He'd asked her the same question during their preparation meeting and already knew the answer. The Warren job was never meant to be permanent. Their regular cook was to resume her position in Manhattan once they returned from Oyster Bay. Mary studied the judges' faces and saw doubt. She got home from Oyster Bay on a Friday in September 1906. It was a beautiful day, and better still because she had a pocket full of money that had been pushed into her hand from a grateful Mr. Warren. Little Margaret Warren would play again, would beg ice cream off another cook, would grow up and marry and do all the things a girl should do. Her sister, her mother, the two maids, and the gardener would also live. All the family, except for Mr. Warren, had already returned to Manhattan, and Mary had left two of the maids drinking cold watermelon soup on the back patio. They'd hugged her goodbye together, squeezing her between them and saying again what a shock each of them got when she pushed them into an icy bath, clothes and all. They blessed her, thanked her, said they knew they wouldn't have their lives if it hadn't been for her. She'd gotten to the station in plenty of time to catch an earlier train, but she'd written her plans to Alfred the previous week and wanted to stay with the schedule she'd sent in case he planned on meeting her. So she sat on a bench in breezy Oyster Bay and watched a train pull in and then pull away. When she got to Grand Central Station, she waited on a bench again with her bag on her lap to give Alfred a chance to find her. After 30 minutes, she pushed through the grand doors onto 42nd Street and began walking home. Something had come up, she decided. He didn't have time to send word. He probably had a perfectly good reason for not showing up. Because it was a Friday, every rusted fire escape in the neighborhood would be weighted down with damp cottons and thin wools in every muted shade of white, gray, brown. From Patricia Wright's careful calico to the yellowed squares of muslin Mr. Hallinan used to strain his coffee. Where 20 years earlier this had shamed her, now she took comfort in the sight and knew she was closer to home. A few tenants had gotten hold of the new roundabout lines that could be extended out a window into the sky without needing to be anchored on another building or another fire escape. The rooms Mary shared with Alfred were on the 6th floor, at the very top of the stairs. Unlike the narrow tenements of the Lower East Side, 302 East 33rd was a broad building that held within the yellow brick of its exterior walls 36 flats. There was a central staircase, wide enough for 3 bodies to climb the stairs side by side, and from this central stair branched 2 halls that reached north and south, 3 flats per hall, 6 per floor. The 6th floor saw the highest turnover, and some of the rooms stayed empty for weeks at a time. Anyone with rooms on the top floor aimed to get lower as soon as possible, but Mary liked the 6th floor. The rooms always seemed to get better light than those on lower floors, and Mary liked standing at the sink and looking out over lower rooftops. When lying in their bed, she could turn her head toward the window and see nothing but blue sky. When Mary arrived home that Friday in September, she opened the door to their rooms and was hit by the odor of linen that needed washing, rotten banana peels on the counter, the single window shut tight. The letter she'd sent to tell Alfred what time her train was due was open on the table, and she could see that he'd made an effort to flatten the folds. He might have gotten work. It happened that way sometimes. No prospects on the horizon, and next thing, someone comes looking for him with a tip about a company looking for a driver, or need for a man who could shovel coal. Mary said about stripping their bed and washing the linens, but when she had everything soaking in the tub, she couldn't find any soap. She decided to run down to the grocer. Not wanting to break one of the new paper bills Mr. Warren had given her, she went to the jam jar of coins they kept by the stove for the gas meter. But there was no jam jar. No coins. And after 7 weeks of missing him, of hoping he was getting on, Mary was as furious as she'd been the day she left. Sometimes, and staring at the empty space where the jam jar used to live was one of those times, Mary felt she'd tripped into a space beyond fury. A place where all of this was so astonishing that perhaps she was the one who was wrong. She took a deep breath and went over the facts. I told him not to dare touch the gas money. Do not dare, I said to him. And he looked at me like he wouldn't dream of it. His look said, the nerve of you to say that to me. I told him I'd send word when I was due home and if he could have the room straightened a bit. After a 7-week job, I don't want to walk into a pigsty. He was insulted. And now Mary stood in the middle of the kitchen and contemplated the naked bed in the next room, the dirty plates and mugs on the sideboard. She could walk out of the door with the same bag she'd just hauled from Oyster Bay and leave him to manage the sopping bedsheets. She smiled. That would be a surprise to him. But if he's working, Mary reminded herself, he might have needed those coins to make himself presentable. Unpeeling 1 bill from the thick fold in her pocket and leaving the rest hidden in the closet, she went down to the street to buy a cake of soap. She hoped, by the time she came back, washed the sheets and hung them on the fire escape, Alfred would be home. But the dinner hour came and went, and still Alfred did not return. She went down to visit with Fran. "And how's Alfred?" Fran asked. "Glad to have you back?" "Oh, sure," Mary had said, avoiding her friend's eye. "Of course he is." Mary knew for a fact that Franz Robert came home for lunch on any day when he could take the full hour. When 5 o'clock arrived, Mary wrapped her shawl around her shoulders and went out to look for him. For several blocks around their building, quitting time found the streets thick with men. Men rushing for streetcars, men leaning against buildings and in doorframes. As Mary crossed over 33rd Street, she observed that even the horses were wild at quitting time. Several water wagons were heading in a line toward the stables on First, and each horse that passed bent its long, muscular neck and turned a vein-threaded eye toward Mary. Once she crossed 34th Street, she could see the blue door of Nation's Pub on the next block, the flag above, the pair of potted plants that welcomed patrons inside. She walked by the wide door without slowing her pace, granting herself only a small sideward glance, as if the place meant nothing to her, no more than any other business that lined the avenue. The late summer afternoon brought a cool breeze, and Mary pulled the sleeves of her sweater over her hands. Her knuckles felt like two rows of rough stones. When Mary passed Nations again, she took a better look. The window next to the door was clouded, but yes, she thought she saw him, slumped at the end of the bar. Yes, that was the posture he would have after so long sitting. She had no plan except to pass by and confirm that he was there, that he was safe, that he wasn't in any trouble. Once she found him, she planned on going back to their rooms to wait, or to pack her things and leave, or to go about her business and sleep, pretending there was no Alfred and that she was obligated to no one but herself. But on her third pass, the bright blue door swung open and a man stepped out. Mary looked past the open door at the man she thought was Alfred, a blonde man, she saw now, heavy-set, his nose a bit like Alfred's, yes, but nothing else. Then the door slammed shut. "He's told them about me," Mary supposed, "our arrangement. Might have said how much it suits him. Might have had a laugh about it. He was cruel when he drank, but then when he drank more, he was kind again. It all depended on the dose, and sometimes Mary hoped that if he had to drink at all, that he would drink past cruelty and into the Alfred she loved, the one who loved her and told her that he would never have lived so long without her. And my God, she was beautiful. Did she know? Why didn't he tell her all the time? Just one or two drinks past kind Alfred was helpless Alfred, and this was the Alfred she feared she'd meet later on that night. There was no arguing with helpless Alfred, no high horse to ride out into the city streets and away from him. Helpless Alfred would get home around 3 or 4 in the morning and would call for her from the bottom of the stairs. One by one, doors would open from the first floor to the sixth. He'd sit on the very first step, head in his hands, and shout for her without pause, and when every person who had a door onto the stairs woke up from his shouting, they'd shout for her, too. "Where were you?" he'd ask when she finally ran down the 6 flights. She used to bother with tying her robe, but not anymore. "Why didn't you hear me?" "I was all the way upstairs," she'd say in a whisper, hoping to shush him. "I was asleep. I didn't hear you." "Jesus Christ, Mary," Mr. Hallinan on the first floor would say. "Where the hell were you? Why didn't you hear him?" Mr. Hallinan didn't care who in the world saw the graying hair on his belly. Then Alfred would put an arm around her shoulder, his other hand on the railing, and she'd haul him up the 6 flights. In their rooms, she'd take off his shoes, his stinking socks, his pants and shorts. Sometimes he'd realize he was naked and he'd cry, long, ugly sobs full of phlegm that shocked and embarrassed her every time. Sometimes, when she was lucky, he just sank into their bed and went to sleep. The worst nights, even worse than when they fought or when she had to strip him, were the nights where she finally got him upstairs and he sat by the window for an hour or so, looking at the quiet below, before staggering to his feet and going out again. More than any other kind of night, those were the ones that drove her to the agency to ask for another situation, one that would keep her away full time, somewhere far away, where the train back to their rooms would be too long, too expensive for a day's journey. It was a night when he came back home, only to go out again, that had driven her to Oyster Bay. Standing outside Nation's Pub, she tried to think of what else she could do to pass the time and stop herself from wanting to see him, but it was no good. She needed to know what he'd made of his weeks away from her, and she needed to know how he was faring. A body could not hold up long against such an assault, and all summer long, before leaving for Oyster Bay, she'd observed him becoming weaker, his pants drooping around his hips, his broad chest narrowing inside his shirt. His face had taken on a gray-green tinge, and the skin at his neck had loosened, become slack. "Sometimes I think about when we met," she'd said to him on that early August morning when they last fought.
Even in a weakened state, he was no fool and knew the ultimate point she was driving at. Once upon a time, not so long ago, he'd worked. He'd been strong. He'd been handsome. Years ago, she'd had an employer who held back 2 weeks' wages because he thought she was in league with a tutor who'd stolen jewelry from his wife, and Alfred had gone directly over to that grand, glossy black door on West 18th Street, the entrance the family and their guests used, and put the man straight. When Alfred came back and handed over her wages, Mary was so relieved that she sobbed into her hands like the kind of woman she considered her opposite. "What could you have said to him that I didn't already say?" she asked, looking at the bills fanned out on the table.
"Nothing," Alfred had said, and then grinned.
"I guess I had a different way of putting it." She'd been over the story before, hoping to shame him into seeing the difference between now and then, hoping to light the fire that would drive him back to the way he was. On that morning in August, the day she left for Oyster Bay, Alfred wouldn't even humor her.
"Leave, then, why don't you, if you're so disgusted? Go on."
Mary knew women were supposed to be the softer sex, a species so warm and nurturing that God granted them the gift of bearing children, caring for them, looking after a home, nursing the sick to health. But sometimes Alfred made her so angry that all the warmth went out of her body, and instead her thoughts became murderous, if she managed to have thoughts at all. Mary pushed open the door to Nations and took one step inside. One man glanced up and then nudged the man next to him.